Well, we're on the last day in the last chapter, and the most peaceful lines in the whole poem are of the plebis dying, right? And there's a death and there's no resurrection there. It's just down the drain. The image is down the drain, and it's the most peaceful language and rhythms. The most controlled rhythms and so forth in the whole poem. But though it's peaceful, it's not peaceful for Phlebas, because with no resurrection there's no peace. It can sound peaceful to us, but to Phlebas there's no existence after death, and so it's just nothing. And we start with what the thunder said. And last night, the Vespers last night, really was a best last session for the Wasteland. And do, I meant that, do listen to it again. Sig can make a tape and maybe you can pass it around. Listen to it again. It's the best final session on this poem. And we'll see some of why, I think, today. I said before, it's a nightmare here, or it's a guy really going crazy. And one of the effects that Eliot gets in this poem by using these quotations from other sources is to get a tremendous compression in the poem. In other words, a great deal of meaning is given in a very short length of time by using someone else's famous words to say something that you want to say, and then you get about three things said at the same time. You know, so there's a tremendous compression, and the amount of compression in the poem gets more and more and more and more and more, doesn't it? Until what almost everyone is saying is jammed into one simultaneous you get many say realities almost at the same time. Does that make sense? And what's that like? What's that called, Nancy? Yeah, really crazy. Really crazy. When in my own experience, when you almost change persons, oh boy, you really look rough. Ufta, you're feeling okay. You didn't have to come. Is it okay? Okay. Oh. Well.
Are you referring to Eliot writing it, or the kind of personality he's trying to put across?
What is happening to the speaker, you know, at that point? Now, what follows this follows the poem when it's published? Very sane, controlled. What? Note. Got a nice effect, because without those, you guys say the guy who wrote this is crazy. But what follows is footnotes on his own poem, and here I'm referring to such and such, and here I'm referring to such and such, and here I'm referring to such and such. Just that's one way that we can know that it isn't it. You know, all we're not this. The speaker here is not Eliot. Eliot wants us very much to know that. And he does, that's one of the uses of those notes at the end. Because you can imagine what this would do in 22 without the notes. You know, when he's reading. They would get up to the first, read the first stanza or first verse paragraph, and they just quit. You see, the guy doesn't know what he's doing. He's misquoting all those, you know. He's doing all these things that are wrong. You can't do that. He's crazy. And And then the notes act as say, hey, no, I'm not. But this poem has a deterioration in it. We've talked about this before, that there is a deterioration. And some moments of very, very sharp sanity and self-knowledge. You know, we'll, and in this section we'll hit two lines like that particularly. Just, well, a number of lines. It's just click, click, click. They're just very controlled, very sane, very perceptive within this context of stuff that just seems like it's crazy. And that's in the tradition of many of the fools in Shakespeare. They are they say all sorts of crazy things, but they also sometimes say the most perceptive lines of anyone in the play. And there's a tradition of there being a great deal of sanity and madness. There's a great deal, you know, an insane person can come up with some things that just not, you know, just knock you down, and they can be rattling on, and then all of a sudden there's just a bing, they hit you with something that is extremely perceptive of the human condition and perhaps maybe the person that they're talking to and so forth. There is in mental illness, at least the way, you know, what I've experienced is a real shifting of gears. That right at the very moment when I was would be just completely spinning like a wheel, like an engine has a governor on it that keeps it from running too fast. The governor's broken, you know, and it's just going so fast, and there's nothing I can do. And then all of a sudden, click! I've been on top of the stairs, and I can just, you know, I could be just, you know, I would just be going absolutely berserk, and then, you know, tears and the whole. You know, I mean, if you had a, what do you call those things to take care of your pulse and your blood pressure and everything, the whole thing would change just instantly like that. And in this poem, you have these kinds of gear shift. You come to a sane time and you're talking one way, and then all of a sudden, London Bridge is falling down, falling down, falling down, London Bridge is falling down. And he says, I have shored these fragments, I have shored against my ruins. Well, then I'll fit you. Geronimo's mad again. Yeah, he is mad again. And he, boom, there he goes again. That's right at the end of the poem. Another, this talk, this da-da-da talk, very straight, then the how he responds at the end of that. But, well, let's not talk around the thing anymore. Let's get right into it. After the torchlight red on sweaty faces, after the frosty silence in the gardens, after the agony in stony places, the shouting and the crying, prison and palace and reverberation of thunder of spring over distant mountains. He who was living is now dead. We who were living are now dying with a little patience. Okay, well, what's the scene as we read through this? What's the scene there? After the torchlight red on sweaty faces, after the frosty silence in the gardens, after the agony in stony places, the shouting and the crying, prison and palace, and reverberation of thunder. What is that setting up?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the torchlight red on sweaty faces as Judas brings the soldiers with the torch. Frosty silence in the Garden of Gethsemane. The agony in stony places. His weeping and the sweating blood. The shouting and the crying. The palace, the prison, in prison brought before Pilate then, in the palace. The reverberation of thunder. When did that happen? When he died. When Christ died on the cross, and then the reverberation of thunder. He who was living is now dead.
Well, that can take couple of things. In this, if it was historical, it would be if he died at the ninth hour. But with the next two lines, perhaps that he who was alive in our life is dead. Therefore, we who are living in our God.
Yeah, in the sense that he who was living in us is now dead. That's, that would, Gerontian would support that, wouldn't it? That's another application of it, yeah. And here you have, he who was living is now dead, separating he. There's a real separate he there. He who was living is now dead, and we, you know, and we, these people over here, we who were living are now dying with a little patience. Now that's one of those perceptive lines that comes from a philosopher, a theologian, somebody in complete control of himself says, you know, out of this, you know, in this strange, you know, this sort of collage that he's got, then there comes this statement, he who was living is now dead. We who were living are now dying with a little patience. Yeah.
Why does it say we're living instead of our living?
We're living while he was living. And now that he's dead, we're just dying with a little patience.
We're living while he
was. Yeah, I think that's the only way you could take those lines is that...
That's your summary point.
Hmm?
Unless you're not living and you're not...
Yeah. Hmm. Well, that's one of the big images, or big things in Eliot, is that you've got a breathing dead, you know, the vertical dead, the hollow men. They're alive, but they're dead. You know, and that seeing many lives that are dead. And an image that I've used, and it doesn't mean that they look like they're dead or anything like that. They can be the heirs to city directors, they can be Queen Elizabeth, they can be nymphs, whatever. It's the life along, you know, in the furnished grave. You can live a life in a furnished grave. So it's just this hole that you create.
Is that Eliot speaking?
Oh, where?
Well, that was not a Christian. I don't see why he could say that. Wasn't a Christian at this time, he wouldn't say that.
But
because Christ is dead, we're dying.
Mm-hmm. I think, really, who was I talking to, Karn, was it? Or Nancy? About talking to some last night. I think it's a poetry thing. I think in a sense, you know, Eliot wasn't Christian here, but he wasn't Christian in the same sense that I wasn't Christian when I was in the mental hospital. Which meant that what I was fighting was good and evil, and now was the battlefield, and there was a war going on, but I didn't know who was fighting. And I wasn't a Christian, but there was a very Christian war. There was a holy war going on inside me. See? But I wasn't a Christian at the time. In and out, wish it was so, but it isn't, so forth. It would be nice if Christ really meant, you know, was who he said he was and did what he said he did. But, you know, I couldn't stay there that long. And that's a lot of that sort of craziness was involved with that. And the wars were definitely, I mean, if you guys show me a Rorschach test, I'd say, I wasn't a Christian, but they can show me a Rorschach test. And I say, oh, that's, who's that? And I say, well, that, well, it's, wow, it's just ink. He says, no, what is it? You know, say what you really see there. And I say, oh, that's Christ right there. Well, what's that over there? And he says, well, that's a spider, I suppose. Well, what's the spider doing? Well, it's going to come in. Well, you see, that's really not Christ, that's me. You know, that kind of talk. And that's really not a spider, that's the devil. And I would be thinking that I was saying, just, I was talking over coffee. You know. And it was really odd. The funny thing about that I was going to psych him out, I was going to kind of do a Jack Nicholson and get my way out of there, and I was going to say, I know about these Rorschach tests. You know, I've had some. I'm going to say only exactly as objectively pictured. I was going to psych him out. And on the basis of what I was trying to do in reality, they called me every name in the book. I thought, yeah, that's Christ there. So that's... But,
How do you know that he isn't a Christian here?
Hmm?
Is it evident in the poem that he isn't a Christian?
The speaker isn't. It's evident in the poem that the speaker isn't.
Why?
Hmm?
Why?
Well... We'll get to it. But Eliot is writing about, you know, again, to separate Eliot from the guy that's doing the talking. And we'll see that. We'll see that. We'll get back to that. Want to talk about it.
I don't understand why Eliot would want to write a poem where he isn't saying that he believes. I don't understand why anybody would want to write a poem where he doesn't think the same.
Do you think that's against what things are done, the way things are written?
Mm-hmm.
Like the Grand Inquisitor chapter? Dostoevsky?
He's writing what he sees, not what he believes.
Yeah, well...
What he sees is exactly what he believes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, he's creating something. I mean, he's got a bunch of voices in here. Now, does it come from him? I mean... Could a guy write a chapter like the Grand Inquisitor without having held at one time that kind of position? No. But that isn't all of Dostoevsky. And then you've got Zazima. Is Dostoevsky Zazima? No. But how can you write like that if you haven't thought through that stuff and had that been part of you? How about Dmitri? You know, all those characters. And yet... You know, Dostoevsky's, in a sense, bigger than all of them. I mean, he wrote all that stuff. And in this, how can he do something like the carbuncular young man and the typist without as a writer being able to really see the world through the eyes of the carbuncular young man? I mean, there is something about himself in all the characters, but there none of them are the, you know, are him. And if I want to in lots of ways, if you ask me a question and then I want to answer that question, I can't answer your question. I've got to do something else first. I would say Eliot is doing something here, saying something here. But he's not saying this is an autobiography. Poets don't write autobiographies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even Whitman. I sing a song of myself. But Whitman wasn't the voice. The voice of the Whitman's poems is somebody besides Whitman himself. You know. Because that's that stuff, a lot of that stuff that happened in Whitman's poems happened at Whitman's desk. So it's not autobiography, you know. It came through his head, but it happened at his desk. And that's, that poem, you guys, read if you're interested in reading a poem that's really oddly different, have a lot of autobiographical, elements to my poetry, but read Firebreak, the poem Firebreak after Gide, which is in the speaker is an absolute immoralist, complete devil, just a total bastard. And he's just talking for this long poem, and I think it pulls off all right. I mean, Milton in Paradise Lost writing Satan's lines. And writing Satan's lines a lot better than he wrote anyone else's lines. And yet he's not Satan. This is a hard poem because you don't. I'd say he wasn't a Christian, but well, let's get back. Historically, he wasn't. No one knew he was. We who are living are now dying with a little patience. Now you curse God. In a sense, you curse God, and you're having a real relationship with God, aren't you? When you say "God damn you, God," you've got the vertical conversation going. Ivan, I won't forgive you, God. He's really got something going there. And then for somebody, if you're saying somebody who says "he who was living is now dead, we who were living are now dying with a little patience," in this context, you're talking about something there was something I had once and I don't have it anymore. And that there's been something alive and now something is dead. That's not Christian, but that's not un-Christian either. It's this sort of middle ground stuff. Here is no water, but only rock. Rock and no water and sandy road. The road winding above among the mountains, which are mountains of rock without water. If there were water, we should stop and drink. Amongst the rock, one cannot stop or think. Sweat is dry and feet are in the sand. If there were only water amongst the rock. Dead mountain, mouth of carious teeth that cannot spit. Ufta. Dead mountain, mouth of carious teeth that cannot spit. Oof. Here one can neither stand nor lie nor sit. There is not even silence in the mountains, but dry, sterile thunder without rain. There is not even solitude in the mountains, but red sullen faces sneer and snarl from doors of mud-cracked houses. If there were water, no rock. If there were rock and also water, and water, a spring, a pool among the rock. If there were the sound of water only, just the sound. I don't want the rock and the water. But just give me something. Give me a rock or give me the water. Or the water and not the rock. But no, if there were only the sound of water only, and something coming in through my senses that's got a positive ring to it. Not the sound of water and not the cicada. You've heard, what a cicada is? June bug? You know what the June bug sounds when it's zooming around underneath the light in summertime? That's a cicada sound. Sound of water, not the cicada, the dry grass singing, but sound of water over a rock. Sound of water over a rock, and he has his cake and eats it too, and he says, "I just want the sound of water." That sound of water would mean a rock, and it would also mean water, wouldn't it? I just want the sound of water. I want to hear. Hear something. The spirit blows over the dry land unheard. And I want to hear this, and if I hear it, then there's this other stuff here too. Where the hermit thrush sings in the pine trees, drip, drop, drip, drop, drip, drop, drip, drop. But there is no water. Who is the third who walks always beside you? When I count, there is only you and I together. But when I look up ahead, up the white road, there is always another one walking beside you, gliding wrapped in a brown mantle, hooded. I do not know whether man or woman. But who is that walking on the other side of you? And that's one movement. the next movement of the poem. Well, and I said last night, and I've said today, and I said yesterday, that the whole poem takes place in the road to Emmaus, kind of, in this sense. God's, you know, Christ has died but hasn't been risen. And you're sitting there, what to do? What do we do now? I mean, like if the person were a disciple of Christ and you really didn't understand what he was talking about all that time, as the disciples must not have, because they didn't know that he was going to rise. They weren't waiting for him to rise. They were on the road to Emmaus. They weren't waiting, sitting there waiting. Okay, you're going to rise. And sit there waiting out in front of the grave. Come on, 3 days. No, they were going to Emmaus. They were leaving town. You know. Or they were running away. Yeah.
The disciples retreated from Emmaus, didn't they? The fear of
the rest. Is it running away there? Yeah.
Yeah. And hid in the kingdom.
Well, at the point. I'd have to check it. I'd want to check it, I guess, to see a number of the reasons. Because I know they were astounded. I mean, they didn't believe the women. What? Oh, somebody must have stolen them. I mean, they gave the criticism that lots of people give to God. No, somebody must have stolen it. Risen? No. And they were thinking that kind of thing. Thomas won't believe it. Won't believe it. Doubting Thomas Stearns Eliot, but anyway, you have you know, they're on the road to Emmaus. They think something's over and nothing started yet, and well, yeah, and they're also going on a pilgrimage, like the Fisher King business, you know, to go and heal the land and so forth, right? And then pilgrimage in the old sense, you go in on a pilgrimage to heal your own sickness, not just the land sickness, but you went on a pilgrimage to heal your sickness. You went on the pilgrimage to heal the land sickness, to where the Percival would go to the Chapel Perilous and ask questions about the lance and the grail, and then if he asked the right questions, then fertility would come back to the land, if he asked the right questions. And then you have this. On top of those two things, you have the road to Emmaus, and the Christ is dead, and now you've walked away. Now here's the simultaneity again. You know, you've got three different things meeting at the same time. There's compression, you know, just all sorts of things. Now, some things that you can notice here: the fear of water is gone. You do have thunder, but it is sterile. It's dry, sterile, kind of heat lightning, that kind of thing. Without rain, there's hope unfulfilled, and there is not even solitude in the mountains. The mountains were what were sought after early in the poem. We'll go to the mountains, you know. We'll go to the mountains. No, the mountains aren't any good anymore. Can't go there. The red sullen faces sneer and snarl from doors of mud-cracked houses. And then kind of bargaining. See, there's not... You know, I can't, if there were water, we could stop and drink. The rock isn't enough. And then he says, I want water. No, I'll have a rock. And then he says, well, heck, I did, just no rock. If there were rock, anything, he's just, you know, really pulling for straws. And all he gets is the sound of a bird that goes drip, drop, drip, drop, 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 like Chinese water torture. And then who will never leave you? You know, you say, who is the third who walks always beside you? And Christ won't ever leave your side. Walks always beside you. But we don't know who he is. Somebody's walking beside you, but who is he? Who is it? It doesn't even know. I count. But then when I look up the white road, these are all ambivalent images that he's using here, because you're not going to be able to nail down, say, ah, oh, he meant that by the white road. But when somebody says the white road, you imply there are other roads. When I look up the white road, I always see this guy next to you. But then when I look some other way and I count, and I can't see. I can't see you. or you can't see anybody but you and I. I can't count anymore, but there is somebody there who I can't count. They're there. What is the sound high in the air? Murmur of maternal lamentation. Boy, the sound of that line is really something. Murmur of maternal lamentation. Who are those hooded hordes swarming over endless plains, stumbling in cracked earth, ringed by the flat horizon only? By the flat horizon only. What is the city over the mountains? Now, the city over the mountains, what, in the city in the air, the city of God, the city in the air, city over the mountains, is that what it is? What is that? What is the city over the mountains? Heaven? No. Cracks and reforms and bursts in the violet air. Falling towers, Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London, these are all hope towns, the peak towns of all these civilizations, and they're all crunching, falling, crashing down. Civilizations are deteriorating. Not just this one in England, but you've got this sort of flux of history, this cycle of history where all these civilizations are crumbling. And now in this one here, London is crumbling too. Unreal. The woman drew, now you've got what here? These images here are the crazy images, the nightmare images of a more obvious nightmare quality. A woman drew her long black hair out tight and fiddled whisper music on those strings. You know, it's changing realities. And bats with baby faces in the violet light whistled and beat their wings and crawled head downward down a blackened wall and upside down in air were towers tolling reminiscent bells that kept the hours and voices singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells. Now, what do you make of that?
The thing that strikes me is a lot about the sound. Very definite sound images. Every line, every image has a sound that goes with it. They seem to build up towards the end. Like
an
image of the city falling down right in the middle of it all.
Mm-hmm.
With the towers.
Well, like a complete inversion, isn't it? I mean, and the bat is a real evil image, and the bat hangs upside down and crawls downward down the walls. Yeah. A woman drew her long black hair out tight and fiddled whisper music on those strings. The sound, as far as the sound of those lines, are beautiful. You know, descends. They really contrast, though, don't they? Mm-hmm. A woman drew her long black hair out tight and fiddled whisper music on those strings. And bats with baby faces in the violet light whistled and beat their wings. They crawled head downward down a blackened wall and upside down in air were towers tolling reminiscent bells that kept the hours and voices singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells. And that comes from where? Jeremiah. And he calls his people. There's the prophetic again. And the Old Testament prophet is voices in here. And in a sense, in this poem, the one that's filled with so many voices, you've got singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells. There's a fatigue here, you know, in this poem. Being worn down. The human spirit is being worn down. And the poem wears you down, too. Because you're getting tired of this poem. Not of this poem, but of what's thinking about this. There's got to be a good line in here somewhere. I mean, something's got to happen.
The cisterns, I sort of see
children playing in the mud of empty wells, and still they're singing, and they don't know what's happened wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're still just, ah,
yeah, yeah.
And the whole city is like after an atomic blast. It's just coming down around them, and the evil, you see the city through the evil of the bat's eyes.
That's Donne, and that's John Donne when he says in a sermon meditation, and when someone dies and then the bell rings and someone dies, and then you know that someone's died, and he says, and don't ask for whom the bell tolls, opposed to you. But his point is, that's a shock line of his, and he goes on and says that if ever a clod of the continent falls, you know, if just a clod washes away from the continent into the ocean, Europe is the less. It is his next image, and then trying to say that we're really all together in this, you know, and when someone dies, we die a little bit. Mankind dies. We had the bells before that kind of put people in prison and let them out of prison again. Well, put them in prison, I won't say let them out of prison. Singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells. And then what Liz said about, you know, singing out of these, you're in them. You're in these things. The Jeremiah passage is that you've carved out cisterns for yourself, empty cisterns that can hold no water. And here, you're singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells. You're down in them. And then you've got a grave. You've dug your own grave image here. Also, another thing, everything up here is turned upside down. There are all these upside down images. And things look upside down if the world is upside down and you're right side up, or if the world is right side up and you're upside down. If you're sane and the world is crazy, or if the world's crazy and you're sane, you know, then things look upside down too. And which is it here? And can it be both? Can a guy both be sane and crazy? In this decayed hole among the mountains, in the faint moonlight, the grass is singing over the tumbled graves. About the chapel, there is the empty chapel. Only the wind's home. It has no doors, and it has no windows, and the door swings. Dry bones can harm no one. Only a cock stood on the roof tree. Cocorico, cocorico. In the flash of lightning, then a damp gust bringing rain. Decayed hole among the mountains in the faint moonlight. I don't know, you just leave that as a literal image, but moonlight is imagination too, and the faint imagination left. The grass is singing over the tumbled graves. About the chapel, there is an empty chapel. Only the wind's home. And remember that there, in the Fisher King, he was supposed to go to the chapel and find, you know, and ask questions. And then health would come back to the land. And now here is a empty chapel and only the wind's home. In other words, it's no one else's home. No one else is at home in the chapel. No one else is at home in the chapel. And it's you've got this ambivalence again. Is it empty? Or is the spirit at least there, but no people can go in there and feel at home? Is it empty or what? Yeah.
Or that no people go in there, and so that no people do feel.
Yeah, yeah. But it definitely says that no one, that it's not home for anyone, anything but the wind. And Eliot does use wind as pneuma and as spirit. Well, you've got a positive and you've got an empty chapel, only the wind's home. Here's a which is it, good or bad? Is it positive or negative? Is it, there's some hope there or not? The empty chapel. The empty chapel that has no windows could be a cave. An opened cave. And you've got the grave, open grave of Christ. Possibility there. Association there. It's written in there. But you don't have enough to make any sense. You just don't have enough to nail it down. Say he's expressing X. You can't say that. Dry bones can harm no one. Only a cock stood on the roof tree. Cocorico, cocorico. Now, the note on that is, well, you know that when the cock crows in Christian, you know, in our story, what does it mean? Yeah. Yeah, the betrayal, the denial. And then also it means that the morning is coming. There's a new morning, you know, here it comes, a new morning. And you've got the cock crowing twice, and is it going to crow the third time? And signal, you know, the third betrayal, the betrayal. Is this going to signal, is this particular cock in the poem going to signal a new morning, a hope, or is it going to signal another betrayal? Yeah, Kurt, you were going to say something. No? Okay, then we, yeah.
Why, I know.
Oh, Steve.
Something bothers me about sound in the poem. Some of them are written out, like here, and especially in the previous parts. He writes out the sound.
What do you mean?
Like Cocorico and La Vila. And, yeah, different sounds. In some places he describes them, like in the section before, the whistling, and he uses words to describe them. And in other places he writes them out. He uses the actual words to be the sound.
Mm-hmm.
What was that all about? Is that anything?
Well, in this case, it's like if you were German and you were writing this, you'd say kickety-key. No, you wouldn't say kickety-key. You'd say, ah, what is it in German? Each language seems to have a different.
In French, it's cocorico.
Is it okay? In
it's like that, except with the like cocorico. That's what it is in French.
Okay, and then in.
It's French, I mean.
And I can't remember. And it's cockadoodledoo. That's what we do. And in Chaucer, it was Chanticleer. How? What did Chanticleer? Wow. Chanticleer did a special call. I can't remember what it was. You maybe have just done this. Can you remember what he said? Yeah. But he has a different one. So that's, in this place, it's just like, you know, it's just to say the call, I think. And leave it at that. The one in the Waihalile thing, you have refrains and ballads and things that are like that. You know, on a hey nani nani, you know, or something like that. And it's sort of just a nonsense thing, I think, which goes along with songs. In this case, it's just, I think, a straight, just, I don't want to mean anything. Why would he talk about sounds? Because if you talk about it, you have chances to do more than just give a sound. You're getting your meaning. Murmur, maternal lamentation. Wow, lamentation. Maternal. Would sustain, can smother. Lamentation, maternal. Murmur, not distinct. So forth. See, you get to mean more if you're talking about it. And then if you don't want to mean more at that particular point, you can just, and that's why I think he does Cocorico here. Just wants to get it out. And then he does it twice. I don't know if that is that significant, but you are kind of go, wait for the third. Because Peter didn't know until the third. When he betrayed him, you know, the cock crowed three times. Is there going to be a third, you know, is there going to be a betrayal coming up? Is there going to be a new hope coming up? Is there going to be three denials coming up? or is it going to be new hope? Ganga was sunken, and the leaves waited for rain, while the black clouds gathered far distant over Himavant. That's the Ganges River was sunken, and the limp leaves waited for rain, and the black clouds gathered far distant over, I suppose, the Himalayas. The jungle crouched, humped in silence. You know, you get a real tension, you know, there. Then spoke the thunder. Da. The interpretation is data, isn't it? Data. Means give. It's a command. You know, God is supposed to be speaking. Da. Give. And what does he say? My friend, blood shaking my heart, the awful daring of a moment's surrender which an age of prudence can ne'er retract. By this and this only we have existed, which is not to be found in our obituaries, or in memories draped by the beneficent spider, or under seals broken by the lean solicitor in our empty rooms. What is that?
Sounds almost like a commitment. Like a religious type commitment, that offer daring of the moment of surrender.
Is it about that lady? After her dad's come? About which really God Jesus isn't in what we are on earth? Is that how we know that Christ was? And so that is the only way of resisting. Is it that lady back in her room after she was put in the chemicals automatic hand? But is it in the thunder speaking to the lady gone?
Well, this is the thunder says give. And then he responds. The thunder says da, and then it's give.
How do you know it's give? I don't see that.
That's down in the footnote.
And then da responds.
The thunder says da, in the Buddha's, what do they call it, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, and the thunder speaks da, and then the thunder is the Lord of creation. Says give, and that's what the people have interpreted the da to mean, give. And then the speaker asks, what have we given, my friend? Blood shaking my heart, the awful daring of a moment's surrender which an age of prudence can ne'er retract, by this and this only we have existed, which is not to be found in our obituaries or in memories draped by the beneficent spider or under broken seals by the lean solicitor in our empty rooms. Does he say they've given anything? Does it answer the question? It almost sounds like it does, but it doesn't, does it? Now, what, you know, this awful daring of a moment's surrender, you know, that is just as you said, Steve, you know, the awful daring of a moment's surrender. Give up.
Is that the thunder speaking?
No, this is the speaker answering the question. Give, and he says.
He's speaking to the thunder.
I don't know my friend. I don't know what to do with that. By something we have existed, but it was not really doing anything. A moment's surrender which an age of prudence can ne'er retract. but the surrender hasn't taken place in the thing. It half sounds like there is, but it isn't. In other words, nothing has been given. Mm-hmm. Nothing has been given. And you've got proof rock in this age of prudence. So scared, But if I do surrender, then I can't take it back. Or if I do act, I can't take it back.
Talking about the age that he's writing from, the age of prudence, whatever it is, 1922 or something. Is the age of prudence now when he was writing?
Mm-hmm. I think so, but it's now too.
Yeah.
But there isn't anything really done there. By this and this alone, and this only, we have existed, but by what? Blood shaking my heart. It's about all you can say. By we've existed. Well, there isn't really. And so what is that? God, the Lord of creation, is commanded, give. He didn't. Okay, the next one. Da, which means sympathize. I've heard the key turn in the door once and turn once only. We think of the key, each in his prison, thinking of the key. Each confirms a prison. Only at nightfall, ethereal rumors revive for a moment a broken Coriolanus. And the Lord of creation says, sympathize. And he answers, I have heard the key turn in the door once, and turn once only. We think of the key, each in his prison, so that the key that turned once did what? Locked us in. Each in his prison, thinking of the key, waiting to hear the sound, waiting for to be let out. Each confirms his prison. Only at nightfall, ethereal rumors. There's a rumor. There's a heavenly rumor that just for one moment, revives a broken Coriolanus. But just for a moment, there is a kind of a revival. Now, the Coriolanus thing is a really complicated. I don't know where to put it, but Coriolanus is a tragic. It's a tragedy. Coriolanus' problem was pride, and his pride was broken, and he was killed. He went, I don't know if the whole story needs to be done, but I think pride broken, then there's a revival of a rumor. A revival of some kind of respect and pride, I think. That's about all I can make out of it. There's a lot of other stuff, but I couldn't get any closer than that, I don't think. But so in sympathize, what does that have to do with sympathize, the demand that we sympathize and be compassionate? In order to sympathize, you have to do what? Give up pride? Yeah, that's true. That's true. What more? Now you've got, what does this, we're locked in a prison, have to do with sympathize? Being locked in a prison. In order to sympathize, you have to what? Get out of yourself. And it's yourself that, yeah.
Forgive others. Forgive the pride in them. Let them out of their prison. But if you turn the key one time,
if you're doing this to someone else, yeah. I think what you're saying is true. I don't.
But is it just for us, as far as his voice is demanding sympathize?
We're supposed to sympathize. Human beings, each individual is supposed to sympathize. And then he says, I've heard the key turn once. I'm locked in, which means that he can't synchronize. He can't get out.
But he heard the key.
Out.
He heard the key, and that was the invitation, and it could have let him out. But he chose to lock.
Well, he says, I heard the key turn only once. I'm in a prison. Uh-huh. And that means he's locked in.
Couldn't it mean that it's just like a half letting him out? Giving him a little taste? Because you can, if it's two turns to open the door, you might be able to
turn it. Yeah.
But he it doesn't, well, we think of the key each in his own prison, and then thinking of the key confirms the prison.
We didn't think of it, but I'm doing it now.
Well, a lot of what you're saying, you know, is true to me. I mean, makes great sense. But I think, take a look at the Eliot's note, because I think this is one of the very important notes that he did give us. It's from Bradley's Appearance and Reality. My external sensations are no less private to myself than are my thoughts or my feelings. In either case, my experience falls within my own circle. A circle closed on the outside, and all its elements alike. Every sphere is opaque to the others which surround it. In brief, regarded as an existence which appears in a soul, the whole world for each is peculiar and private to that soul.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I think of it in great divorce terms.
Mm-hmm.
That I'm thinking of, you know, if he didn't think of the key, and well, hearing that chinkling, that invitation to sympathize with the other person, he could have just walked right out and it wouldn't even have been a prison. But thinking of the key, it confirms his prison, confirms his own existence inside this thing.
It's kind of like the self-awareness of yourself, being conscious of yourself, thinking of that. Mm-hmm. And also, pride falls in with that a lot because that's thinking of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You have to.
Oh, it's like. Well, what you started there is that when you do think of a key, something to let you out, you confirm a prison. Mm-hmm. By what you hope for, and he hopes for a key and to let him out. And that confirms a prison. I don't feel comfortable with that. You know, it's done, you know, is everything. But the Eliot's note on this passage is that we're stuck. Here's again your cistern, your grave, your solipsism. How can I sympathize? Because I can't get out of myself, and neither can you. And what's real to you is all yours. Well, what's real to me is all mine, and it's hard for me to sympathize in any specific sense, except that maybe we all are in prisons. But I don't know, and I'll never know, because that's only the way it appears to me, and that's private to me. And you can't see or know what I know, and I can't see or know what you know. So how suited are we, if what Bradley says is true, to sympathize as the Lord of Creation asks us to.
Mm-hmm.
we can't. Right? Can you see how that works?
It's not something that comes from ourselves. It's like the agape love.
The bayabam is compassionate. And, passion together. And you can't be together. Just in this whole thing, no one's been able to touch. You know. There hasn't been any touching in this whole thing. And that you can't get out of these, we're all in these cisterns. And we can't get out of them. And that's what the speaker is talking about here.
Where does the key fit in, John? Who holds the key? Who holds the key that locks us in?
I don't know.
I'm really bothered by this idea right now. I don't think that this could be right. I have to think about it some more time. I thought about this way. I got to find out who's holding the key. That's really mm-hmm. important to me right now. I mean, more than the form. Like who's holding who? I got to find that out.
I don't think I can help you. I've heard the key in the turn in the door once. You turn once only. We think of the key each in his prison.
Thinking of the key each confirms a prison.
That's kind of the way that every tank could go is that
we do it to ourselves. I don't think that is it. It's a neat idea, but I don't think it's it, and I can't.
In this footnote, it says, in either case, my experience falls within my own circle. It's closed on the outside. And to think that he's not in control of it, but he's in it, and it's closed from the outside.
Yeah. And that is one of the ideas of philosophical ideas that we live with. It's one of the positions, is that this is true. What Bradley says is true. I think something Eliot is saying, that if this is true, this is the way the world is. If that's true, if Bradley's right, then this follows what we have here. There can't be any compassion, community, congregation, conjugal love, any of the together words, you know, it can't happen if this is true. And many, many people think it's true, that a lot of the relative business comes from this. I mean, the solipsism, relative, it's the reality, it's up here. And that's it. And I can't say anything about that. Well, then what does it say? Well, if you can't say anything about that, then if you're not any better than your principles, you'll end up in a mess. You know? Yeah.
Well, also another kind of substantiation.
Yeah. Yeah.
What does that mean? Well, that's the sacrament in breaking of the bread when it's sanctified to bring
that the body of Christ, together with the mm-hmm. bread and wine,
mm-hmm.
that you
mm-hmm.
the
mm-hmm.
Yes.
John, what does ethereal mean? Ethereal? Heavenly. That somebody else is out there and maybe can let us out, but we can't. But think of, we've got this, all this enclosed, self-enclosed people. They can only touch. It would be nice to write a paper on all the enclosure images in this poem, you know. You're just stuck, enclosed. Well, in other words, he says, sympathize. I can't. or he assumes he can. Then the next one, control. The boat responded gaily to the hand, expert with sail and oar. The sea was calm. Your heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to controlling hands. Control yourself.
Where do you get control yourself? It sounds to me more like a grand inquisitor type of question.
Mm-hmm. The boat responded gaily to the hand expert with sail or oar. Sea was calm. Your heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient through controlling hands. Control yourself, and this is an image of yeah, if any control, someone else's control. We don't have those expert hands. We don't have the hands that are expert with sail or oar, and we would desire that someone else controls.
It almost requires that, because ties back to the Plevis thing. Because when Plevis was controlling his own ship, he died.
Well,
sad to check now.
Let me check.
I was just thinking that. And look at line 320.
Yeah, it's the, you who turn the wheel and look to windward. Talking of someone who does control. You're at the wheel anyway. You're at the wheel whether you can control it or not. And I think what, at least it's, you know, the reader is, the possibility is there. But here, the boat responded gaily to the hand expert with sail and oar. The sea was calm. Your heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to controlling hands. And as far as control yourself, the answer is be controlled. And what Kathy said is the reading that I've given it in terms of we can't. That the Grand Inquisitor. We would welcome somebody to run us. So the cock crowed and the thunder said three things and he responds with what, three betrayals? Three denials? Yeah.
The cock crew,
the cock crew.
But in Mark, it says, you were denying three times before the cock crows twice.
Oh, it does. Good, thank you. Okay. All right. Well, then, you know, that fits
so
right in there.
The denial has
yeah. Well, the denial has taken place prior to the cock crowing at that point in the poem, and then he's just admitting it at this point. See? The cock crowed, and he answers in the past tense. And then the thunder said, give. And then also, I get something in here where Christ says, you know, why hast thou forsaken me, kind of, and then the thunder says, well, have you given? No. Have you sympathized? No. Have you controlled yourself? No. Well then, that answers your question, you know, of the individual. No. But of the question that you have, why hast thou forsaken me?
What what measure...
I mean, this is something that the poem asks, isn't it? Why hast thou forsaken me? Kurt?
That, talking about what measure you give to the man, so I shall give to you.
Mm-hmm.
And he hasn't done through his life what he expected to receive.
You really don't have, again, the speaker doesn't like what he sees, but there is something here that, you know, you've heard the word, why hast thou forsaken me, and identified with it. But you haven't heard, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. There just isn't any of that in here. And it's, the subject is, in a sense, you're talking about outside, but the subject seems to be the individual himself. You know, it's just me. Okay, let's go.
Well,
yeah.
Before these connections were a ship in a whirlpool, and now that's a calm sea. And how can both respond gaily on a calm sea?
Think the body responded gaily to the hand expert with sailing oar, knew how to drive it. The body responded gaily to the hand that knew how to drive it.
What is the sea? The sea was
just life, I think. Body would have responded gaily to the hand that was expert. In other words, the mind is there. But hand and oar, the life was calm. Your heart would have responded gaily. Well, now you've got boat gaily, heart gaily.
But it's, if life is going well and you're asked to respond, it would seem that the response would come being obedient if you think that you want to be controlled when you can't do it, when you're sure now that you can't do it yourself. And I didn't get that from the...
When things are going easy for you, it's hard to put your control in somebody else's hands.
Yeah.
Yeah, but maybe he's at the point where things are already gone now. He's already...
Well, if she was calm, your heart would have responded gaily, but it's somewhere beyond the...
Okay, I'd take the thing as two. It's an interesting thing I hadn't thought of before, is that what you've got is a... You've got a split. That the boat responded gaily to the hand expert with sail and oar. The sea was calm. Image, you know, of something happening. A situational image. Well, it's an analogical metaphor, you know, which is kind of doubling, almost redundant, but it isn't. There is such a thing as an analogical metaphor. There is a situation. And like that situation, your heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to controlling hands. But you've really got somebody else's hands there. Beating obedient to controlling hands. that you don't have. There aren't any. Although a boat... You know. Well, you can. I mean, the wind. You go sailing, you don't have to have a... I mean, when the wind blows, your sea can still be calm, and you can sail gaily without fear of death by water. You know. And the boat responded gaily to the hand expert with sail and oar. The sea was calm. Your heart would have responded gaily when invited, beating obedient to controlling hands. But I don't have those expert hands, and I would find some controlling hands, but none can. And in the sense that if I'm in a prison, it's not that there just isn't any chance. But what you have is, you know, three betrayals. The three things are salvations. You know, give according to the Buddhist thing. Give, sympathize, and control, self-control. And we can't. It's impossible. It's impossible. It's impossible. So, I assume I'm left alone. God has commanded that I do these three things, and I can't do them. Well, that leaves it up to me. I sat upon the shore fishing, the arid plain behind me. Shall I at least set my lands in order? Can't set myself in order. Shall I at least set my lands in order? Assuming that he's been disinherited by God. In a sense, my sons give, sympathize, and control themselves. I can't sympathize, can't do these things. So I'm no son, I'm disinherited. And I sat upon the shore fishing with the arid plain behind me. Nice, because it's behind him. And it means behind him, maybe like a jungle, or like this fearful thing, but also behind me. I've gone past that. Well, shall I at least set my lands in order? Here's one of those really sane lines, right? He's responded like that, and then there's a break. Well, I sat upon the shore fishing, the arid plain behind me. Shall I at least set my lands in order? And what follows answers whether he can or not. You know, there's that moment of really first real perception. Now, after this horrible, all these powerful images and you know, really horrible things, and then you come up to the solution. And what's going to be the resolution of all this? Of a dull proverb. You know, this is it. Well, what can I do now in the face of all this? What shall I do? Shall I at least set my lands in order? And that from the line from Dante, you know, God set my loves in order. You know. Well, there aren't any loves, and I've been disinherited, and so I'm left with, well, I can't control myself and I can't do all these things, so can I at least set my lands in order? Yeah.